ID, the future. A podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm your host, Eric Anderson, and today we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Michael Behe about his new book, A Mousetrap for Darwin. Great to chat with you again, Mike.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. It's always great to be here.
Today we'll dive into what is arguably the most famous evolution experiment of the last century. First, set the stage for us a little bit and tell us about this experiment.
Sure. Richard Lenski is a professor, a microbiologist at Michigan State University. And around 1990, he decided to do what seemed like an odd experiment at the time. He decided he would put some bacteria called E. coli, a common laboratory bacterium, into a flask and let it just grow overnight. And it turns out that since it's so small, it reproduces pretty quickly. So that's about six or seven generations just overnight. I should add, he did 12 of these things, 12 different flasks, just for replicability's sake. The next morning, he came in and he took a little bit of the bacteria that had grown in a flask and put it in a new fresh flask with more food for the bacteria to eat. And there was another six or seven generations then till the next morning. And then he did it again and again, and he continued to do it for 30 years. And so now he's up to over 70,000 generations of E. coli, and there have been trillions of these bugs born and died in the flasks of Richard Lenski. So he did that just because he wanted to see how they would change, how they would evolve.
It's really fascinating research, and probably, is it fair to say, the best controlled evolution experiment we have?
Yeah, by far it is. It's most people would do experiments for a couple months or something and a few hundred generations, but this was really long term with lots and lots of organisms, and they were able to track down many of the mutations that the bacteria had undergone.
Yeah, so this is really fantastic research, and I think we owe a debt to Dr. Lenski for all this work. What did they see in terms of how these bugs started to evolve?
Well, that's interesting because it kind of reflects the history of the scientific community's progress as a whole as well. Because back in 1990, they started the experiment and they saw that some cells could grow faster than others and that they had a kind of different shape. They were a little larger, mm-hmm. a little fatter. And so they saw that here was a mutation that helped the cell grow, but they didn't know what it was. And that's because a mutation is a change in DNA, and E. coli has millions of units of DNA, millions of nucleotides. And back in 1990, it was hard to track down what it was. But nonetheless, they continued to do this for the next decade or so because it was hard, again, to track these things down. And they looked at a number of properties of the mutated organisms and wrote down their results.
Right. So early on, when they didn't know or didn't, just because we didn't have the ability, right, to sequence quickly and,
exactly,
and yeah. easily. So they saw that some of these bacteria were growing more quickly and said, gee, isn't it great? There's a quote unquote beneficial change going on here. But then by the early 2000s, they were able to identify some of these mutations. And what did you find when you started to look into what they had discovered?
Well, yeah, when with the advances in abilities to sequence DNA, they were able to go back and look at whatever changes had occurred. And I guess I should mention for the listeners that the neat thing about working with bacteria like they did is that they could take a small portion of the bacterial culture at whatever time point they wanted and freeze it, put it in the freezer. And then they could go back at a later time and check to see what the state of the bacterial evolution was at that point. So
yeah, that's great. Kind of a time capsule, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So in the early 2000s, they went and they looked at the first big beneficial mutation that had shown up, and they were able to show that it was a change in the bacteria's ability to use something called ribose, a sugar. Mm-hmm. And they saw that a couple genes needed for metabolism of ribose were destroyed. There was a kind of a virus-like element that lives in the E. coli, and it had inserted itself right smack dab into the middle of those genes, and that caused them to be broken. But nonetheless, breaking that gene or that set of genes gave a 5% growth advantage to the bacteria. Now, 5% doesn't sound like a lot, but that means in 20 generations, it pretty much has taken over the culture.
Interesting. And so when you were starting to look at these early results that were coming out of this and assessing whether or not there were new innovative results that the E. coli were producing, what was your initial assessment?
Well, I noticed that pretty much all of the changes that they had seen so far looked like they were going to damage genes, and they looked like they were in disparate genes, no particular coherent changes. They were just changes in this and that. There were no, you know, new molecular machines being built, no new protein-protein interactions, nothing like that.
But then in 2008, if we fast forward to that time frame, they published a paper touting the evolution of a key innovation and a new ability that the E. coli had acquired to metabolize citrate in the presence of oxygen. So that seems like a big deal.
Yeah, they certainly touted it, and it got a lot of attention. So they saw that bacteria in one of the 12 flasks were growing a lot more than in other flasks after about 30,000 generations. And when they tested, they saw that, in fact, they were metabolizing some of the citrate that was present in the medium. Now, the citrate was present from the start, along with some sugar, which all the bacteria could eat. But E. coli cannot use citrate as a food source normally, but these bugs learned the trick of using citrate, and that's what got the attention.
Right. And am I correct in understanding that E. coli can already metabolize citrate, but what they didn't have was a way to get it into the cell in the presence of oxygen?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Normally, E. coli has all the apparatus to metabolize citrate, but all genes in cells are regulated so that they're turned on at the right time in the right place. And citrate, there's another protein called a citrate transporter, which is kind of like a gate through which the cell has to pull citrate in from the outside. Citrate can't get in by itself. And normally the gene to make that gate, the citrate transporter, is turned off in the presence of oxygen, but not when there isn't oxygen around. So essentially, the mutation just activated a pathway under circumstances where it normally was not activated.
So to clarify, Mike, a couple of other researchers had already seen this ability of E. coli to metabolize citrate in the presence of oxygen. I think one of the researchers hadn't really identified the cause of that. In another case, they had identified an overexpressed CIT-T gene that allowed the E. coli to use the citrate in the presence of oxygen. And as you were looking at this, you were thinking maybe something similar was going on?
Yeah, that's a fairly common event in the life of a cell, that sometimes genes get turned on when they're not supposed to be. Overexpressed is the technical term. And that can be for any of a number of reasons. And these earlier researchers had seen it. So it seemed likely that something like that would be going on again.
Yeah. And one of the things you mentioned in the book is that it was actually a little bit surprising that it had taken so long, because these E. coli were bathed in, I think, 10 times as much citrate as glucose. And it took, I guess, 30,000 generations almost for them to achieve this.
That's right. Many other mutations that Lenski had reported occurred within a couple hundred generations in his experiment, but this required 30,000 generations.
So while they're doing this great work in the lab and you're observing the results as well as looking at results from some other researchers, you know, you came to a conclusion that maybe this wasn't a great example, or at least the general E. coli experiment was not a great example of how Darwinian evolution can produce wonderful new features. And you came up with something you called the first rule of adaptive evolution. What is that?
Yeah, in 2010, I reviewed Lenski's and a lot of other laboratory evolution experiments and classified them according to whether they produced a new coded feature, such as a new gene, or more realistically, a new promoter or a new binding site or some new coded element. Mm-hmm. And I classified whether the beneficial mutation was one that gained or made a new coded element, or lost one, or kind of tweaked one. And it turns out that the large majority of the beneficial mutations that had been reported by experimental evolutionists were ones that broke, that degraded, where coded features of the DNA were lost. And I came up with a phrase for this. I called this the first rule of adaptive evolution, that you should break or blunt any coded element that would cause a net fitness gain or a net growth in the bacterium. So the reason for that is that it's easy to break genes or break regulatory elements. It's a lot faster to do so than to build one. So since the mutation is random, then you have a lot better chance, a lot quicker to break something. And sometimes breaking something can help the bacterium grow faster.
And so just for our listeners, when these researchers talk about quote unquote beneficial mutations, I mean, in our normal life, in an engineering standpoint, you know, breaking something, destroying something, we wouldn't call that beneficial, but they're saying it's beneficial sheerly because it allowed the bacteria to grow more quickly, or whatever organism they're looking at, to reproduce and be more successful in that sense.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it can be beneficial to get rid of something that's kind of holding you back in a certain circumstances. One analogy I like to use is, suppose you had a nice car, but there were some circumstance arose where your very life depended on your car getting better gas mileage.
Are you proposing the zombie apocalypse or something? You
yeah,
have to get away from
it. Exactly. And things happen. Things like that happen. If that were the case, what could you do quickly to help your car get better gas mileage? Well, of course, you could get rid of weight. You could throw out the doors. You could throw out the hood, get rid of the spare tire, and so on. Of course, those things have uses, but nonetheless, if right now, if your life depends on getting better gas mileage, that's the way to go. And yeah, it turns out, you know, things like that happen at the molecular level too.
And just to be clear again for our listeners, you're not arguing that there are no truly innovative mutations that would take place, but on you know net basis, they're going to be kind of swamped by these
exactly
degradative mutations because it's easier and quicker to go that route.
That's right. In my review paper in the Quarterly Review of Biology, I called it the first rule, kind of like a rule of thumb. You know, this is what you expect to happen. This is not, you know, a law or something says that it has to happen. But statistically, by far, you would expect any degradative mutation that helped to appear a lot faster than any constructive one.
Okay, makes sense. So back to Lenski's experiment, because I think they admitted that a lot of the mutations were degradative, but now they have this 2008 paper which touts a key innovation. And they said this is a novel feature, and there was even a hint that maybe this new capability might be the start of a new species.
Yeah, that's right. But I was skeptical, and so I kept an eye on it. And they didn't know what the mutations were when they first discovered it. It wasn't for another 4 years or so that they tracked down what the mutations were.
Yeah, and so there's a couple of different classes of mutations. I know this can get just a little bit technical, but talk to us about these three different categories of mutations that they had identified.
Yeah, they broke them down into what they called potentiation. And what they mean by that is that some mutation occurred that they did not identify that allowed a later mutation to have a beneficial effect. And then a second category was actualization. That is something that really gave a beneficial effect. And then they called refinement. That is that once you have this beneficial effect, then other mutations can occur which boost it. And they found that the actualization, they haven't tracked down the potentiation as far as I know, but the actualization, what really gave the benefit was that there was a kind of a mutation where a piece of DNA got copied a couple times, duplicated as it's called. And it was around the citrate transporter gene, but it also included parts of another gene. And the other gene had a regulatory element that allowed that gene to be copied when there was oxygen around. And that's the key. When that got accidentally duplicated, a copy of the promoter from the other gene was placed next to a copy of the citrate transporter gene, so that now the citrate transporter gene could be activated and transcribed in the presence of oxygen. So that was the key.
Okay, so let me make sure just for our listeners, because this sounds like where the rubber really meets the road. So this is touted as, you know, metabolizing citrate in the presence of oxygen, some great new ability, but let me make sure I'm understanding this correctly. First, E. coli already have the ability to metabolize citrate. Second, they also have the ability to import citrate from the surrounding environment into the cell, but normally that feature is turned off in the presence of oxygen. So they didn't really have to create any new information or a new capability. All they needed to do was avoid this off switch, and then the cell would import citrate, and voila. So one of the ways to potentially avoid this was to miscopy the gene to a location with a promoter that's active in the presence of oxygen. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, you seem to understand this pretty well. That's exactly right. The mutation rearranged a few elements that were already there. And while that's interesting and that can be important in the life of a cell or a species, it's not producing new coded information. And in my review, I obsessed on this, that in order to explain life today, one has to explain where coded information comes from. We have to ask, can random processes produce coded information such as regulatory sites or genes or many other things? And this did not.
Yeah. So for, you know, if I put on my engineering hat for a minute, the fascinating question for me is, why is the citrate importation switch set to the off position in the presence of oxygen? Do we know why that's the case or what the...
Yeah, that's because when there's oxygen, then citrate is used to break down the sugar. When there's sugar around, citrate is part of something called the citric acid cycle, which is used to generate energy in the cell. And the cell kind of makes its own citrate then too, and doesn't really need much at all. So that's why it stays off in the presence of oxygen. But when oxygen isn't around, then it has to work by a different metabolic pathway. And the citrate can then be used as food.
Okay, so that's fascinating. So in the presence of oxygen, this is really a regulatory element that says, hey, I don't need to import a lot of this stuff from the outside environment.
That's right. It's more efficient to just use the citrate as an intermediary metabolite in this citric acid cycle rather than as a fuel source.
Right. Okay. But when we break it, then things kind of go crazy. We grow faster. If I'm in this very specific situation that Lenski had, right, where there's tons of citrate and we're competing hard with each other.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And then the refinement step is just more copies of this gene duplication, or what's going on there?
Yeah. Well, it depends. A lot of refinement has taken place down the road, but since one is using a different metabolic pathway, if you shut off things that were previously on, that can push more citrate into the pathway where it will be used to produce energy. And so a lot of other genes can be turned off as well. And that's what the refinement does.
We can break more things, refine.
Exactly. It's always good to, you know, to promote your research to use positive, happy sounding words than to say, you know, things are getting blown up left and right.
Yeah. So another thing they identified were several, I think there were more than one, but multiple mutator strains, they called them. What are those?
Yeah, well, mutator strains are ones that have themselves gotten a mutation in a gene that helps suppress mutations or help correct errors in the DNA that inevitably come during the normal processes of replication. So if a gene for a protein that helps to repair the DNA, help suppress mutations, is itself broken, then the rate of accumulation of mutations increases quite a bit. And they're called mutator strains. And the rate of mutation can go up something like 100-fold or more.
Yeah. So again, we have something that's touted as a novel evolutionary change, but the real result, I think, is that the cell has lost its ability to faithfully copy its DNA.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a scream. I remember this occurred, and Lenski's work is very well reported in the popular press. And he said that this new strain had developed, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but a novel way of handling its genetic information. Or and you read the paper and it's doing a lot worse than it did. And if you use happy talk, it seems to be more exciting for some people.
Yeah, that's funny. All right, so let's fast forward then a couple more years. A colleague of yours as a fellow at the Discovery Institute, Scott Minnick, was, you know, questioning Lenski's results and the huge acclaim from this citrate result. And he was also skeptical of their suggestion about the possible beginning of a new species. I think he published in 2016. Tell us a little bit about his experiment.
Yeah, Scott is a renowned microbiologist at the University of Idaho, and he's worked a long time with bacteria. And he suspected that the way in which Lenski's laboratory was going about growing their bugs was a very inefficient way to get them to learn to be able to metabolize citrate. And the reason is that while there was a lot of citrate in the culture, the E. coli much preferred to metabolize sugar, which was also in the culture. So Scott thought that maybe this was slowing that down, the identification of that citrate. And so he grew it in just the presence of citrate without the glucose around. And they were able to show, he and his lab were able to show that it took only a couple of weeks to be able to produce a similar citrate using mutation, not the decades that it took Lenski. And they were able to do it repeatedly and repeatedly and repeatedly. And one of the interesting things to me was that the mutations that came up were pretty much always the same type of thing, the same rearrangements. So E. coli doesn't have a lot of tricks up its sleeve. As in fact, I called it a one-trick pony. And to me, that showed a whole lot more about the great limitations of evolution than about possibilities.
Yeah, so it could do this one thing by breaking a certain set of of elements, but it kind of tended to always go that same route.
That's right.
So what's the big takeaway? Where are Lenski's E. coli now? You know, we've had lots of quote-unquote beneficial mutations in the sense of allowing it to grow faster, you know, loss of the flagella, genes used to make ribose, other degraded genes. What's the overall result, though? Is this a more healthy organism? Is it more capable? If we put it back in the natural environment, would it outcompete the wild type? You know, what's the cumulative result, Mike, of these tens of thousands of generations of evolution?
Well, it's interesting. There's a couple things to say. First, in what I think was 2016 or 17, Lenski's lab published a paper in which they identified the top 30 mutations which helped the E. coli grow faster. And seemingly all of them were ones that degraded genes, that broke the genes or diminished the capacity of the genes. And there were none which looked like they were on their way to new molecular machinery or even new control elements. So yeah, that was great support for my first rule of adaptive evolution. And just a year or so ago, I think it was, his laboratory reported some new results from a bacteria grown on citrate, and they started to grow faster, but they were, again, losing a number of different genes. And one interesting thing that they pointed out was that the number of cells that would die each day was increasing substantially. In the beginning, the beginning strain, 10% of the cells would die each day. But with later ones, as they were refined, the death rate went up to 20% and then 30% and 50% for some strains. And these were strains that were outgrowing other ones. And it was really fascinating that in the paper, one of the comments was that some mutations in the later strains were ones that allowed them to metabolize lipids from the membranes of dead cells. So they were eating their dead, cannibalizing them. That does not sound like it's on its way to something positive. So it's wonderful that Alensky's lab has done this, because it limits our speculations. It grounds us in data. And now we know that, in fact, evolution proceeds mostly by degrading things that were already there.
Yeah, and I think you used the word death spiral as to this last result. I mean, these creatures are heading headlong down this path where, yeah, they're growing faster and faster, but more and more of them are dying off.
That's right. And so they're becoming more and more brittle. They have fewer and fewer genes that they can use. And they're headed towards extinction.
Well, that sounds like de-evolution to me. Maybe you should write a book about de-evolution.
I like that word. Yeah, let me write that down.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for being with us again to help us understand some of the incredibly interesting issues discussed in your new book.
Oh, yeah. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. We've only scratched the surface of this amazing book in our conversation. For lots of wonderful additional details, get your copy of A Mousetrap for Darwin today in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Until next time, for ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.